They're coming out tonight. I know we're sparse even for Sunday night today, but who's got the? How do I turn the? Okay, we'll deal with it. I don't have a slide presentation tonight, so that's why the song was lingering up there. I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight. It's always nice to be here, and it's always nice to see people make an effort to be here, even when it could be doing other things. I want to talk tonight about a man. I want to talk about a particular person who we often view, we look at, and we sort of glance over because we look at him as if he is preparation for something else. And I totally understand why, because to a certain extent that's true. But occasionally it's good to stop and give this man the full treatment. Because there's a lot of really interesting things going on in this guy's life. I want to look at King Saul. I want to look at King Saul tonight. I want to spend our entire night just looking at King Saul. I know recently I did a sermon that was sort of a comparison of Saul and David. Even though it was David and the text David and Goliath, it's not really about Goliath, it's about David and Saul. But I want to look just at Saul tonight. What makes him special? In a very interesting way, he is special in Scripture. He plays this very iconic role that's worth looking at. And it all starts when he's chosen to be king. And I don't want to take the time to read the narrative about how he's chosen to be king, and we're not going to be able to take the time to read the narrative of a lot of what goes on in the life of Saul because they keep telling me there's a trap door, but it hasn't opened up yet. I'm starting to think they lied to me. Starting to think that's just to get me to stop on time. But we are limited by time. We're limited by time tonight, and that's okay. That's how it works. But I do want to stop and consider this man. Because in a lot of ways, he's remarkably unremarkable. That's what Saul is. He's remarkably unremarkable. Now, there's the physical attributes of Saul, the fact that he was head and shoulders above the rest of Israel. I mean, that's talked about when he's chosen to be king. He was a man who is handsome to look at. He's a man of presence, of charisma, a man who's dynamic in his personality. But I want for us to start looking at when Saul was anointed, when he was crowned as king. All of Israel had gathered together. Because Samuel was, I mean, the way this whole thing starts is Samuel is old. And he appoints his sons as his successors, as judges. But the elders of Israel go to Samuel as this big group of 72 guys, and they get in his face and they say, Samuel, you're old, okay? So it's not really wrong to say someone's old. Samuel is old. And the elders tell him, your sons do not walk in your ways. They had started to accept bribes. They had begun to pervert justice. And the elders, that was unacceptable to the elders of Israel with absolutely good reason. And so they say, give us a king. And there's that argument that Samuel has. And God speaks to Samuel and he says, no, actually, listen to him. Listen to him. Give them a king. And we talked in our Sunday morning class about Deuteronomy 17, and it was even brought up in my sermon this morning, Deuteronomy 17. God had actually, my impression of scriptures, God had always planned for them to have a political king. It's just the way they went about it here was the problem, because what they want is they want a king like the kings of the nations around them. That's the problem. That's really the start of everything, and we're going to look at that tonight. So we're going to come back to this text. But this text is, of course, that is 1 Samuel chapter 8. We're going to come back to it at the end of the lesson tonight. But Saul is anointed in chapter 10. All of Israel has gathered together after the Lord, through His providence, has shown Samuel who He has chosen to be king. Everyone's together. And Saul is supposed to be brought out, and there's supposed to be this big public moment and this big celebration. And it's at this place called Mizpah. And so they're there, and they're all together, and they've all gathered the elders of Israel along with the leaders of the tribe, the clan heads of Israel. The clan heads of all 12 tribes are there. And here's Samuel. And he says, "Let us see the one the Lord has anointed." And Saul doesn't come out. I'm sure most of us probably will remember this story, right? Saul doesn't come out. Why? Anybody remember? He's hiding. He's hiding in the baggage. He's hiding in the luggage. He's hiding where everyone has left their bags. He's trying to get out of it. But Samuel goes and he finds him. He brings him. He forces him to the front. He anoints him with oil, puts a crown on his head. And people say, "Long live the king, long live the king." And then the next thing you see is Saul in his own field staring at his donkey's rear end. Because the Philistines have attacked, and he's the king, so he's supposed to defend them, but he doesn't quite know what it means to be king yet, and the people don't really know how to deal with a king yet, so here he is still plowing his own field like a regular Joe. Now that's okay, I don't so much mind that, but the fact is Saul isn't ready. God picked him, and he hasn't prepared himself. Now, he mans up, he goes out, he gathers the army, they fight, he's victorious, God gives him victory. And Saul praises the name of God. But let's fast forward a little while. Now, Saul has gotten used to being king. Now, Saul has a palace. Now, Saul is starting to enjoy the throne. He's starting to enjoy the crown. He's starting to enjoy the power that comes with being a ruler. And so the Philistines are threatening again. And here he is in this position of being leader of the army, going back out to warfare. We're fast forwarding to chapter 13 at this point. And there's this other interesting narrative about Saul. He chooses men of Israel to go and fight with the Philistines. They go join Saul at Gilgal. And the Philistines muster to fight against Israel 30,000 troops, 6,000 horsemen, and troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. And they came up and they camped at Michmash, and they go to the east of Bet-Avon. And so the people saw that the Israelites outnumbered them, because Saul had around 3,000 men. And the Philistines have 30,000. That's a big difference. So the people get afraid and some of them start leaving. And Samuel has promised that he's going to come there to offer a sacrifice to give courage to the army and to let them know that the Lord will bless them. So Samuel has promised to come out of retirement one last time. So here he is, and he comes and he gets there. And what does Samuel see when he gets to the encampment? Samuel had said, 7 days from now, he had sent word to Saul, 7 days from now, I will show up, I will offer a sacrifice, I will bless the armies of Israel, and God will be with you, and he will give you victory over the Philistines. So Samuel finally comes strolling up on the seventh day, late in the seventh day, and what does he see? He sees Saul offering a sacrifice, okay? Now, let's stop to analyze the problem. Number one, Samuel had promised Saul that he was going to go offer a sacrifice. Why is Saul offering a sacrifice? First of all, number one, who were supposed to offer the sacrifices? Priests. Or, on occasion, people that God chose as prophets. They seem to have been an exception to this rule, because all kinds of priests who weren't from Levi gave sacrifices all the time, and God accepted them. So, we'll say priests as the general rule of thumb, with prophets being the exception. Inspired, miraculous, deed-working prophets. Those kind of prophets. So Samuel's a prophet. He's an exception to this. So here he is. And he's going to go up and offer the sacrifice. Well, not only was Saul not a priest, he's from the wrong tribe. He's from Benjamin. The priests are from Levi. They're from a certain clan. Saul's opposite end of the spectrum. And Samuel comes up and says, what in the world are you doing? And what we see is this interaction between Saul and Samuel. And to paraphrase it briefly again, we are limited by time, unfortunately. You know, we'll take the time to read just a little bit. We'll read just a little bit. Samuel said, what have you done? Saul said, when I saw that the people were scattering from me and that you did not come within the days appointed. Hold on a second. I did come within the days appointed. You just didn't wait. And that the Philistines had mustered at Michmash. I said to myself, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself. I didn't want to, but I girded up my loins, and I made myself offer this sacrifice. You don't know how painful it was for me, Samuel, to offer this sacrifice. But I forced myself to do it, and I offered the burnt offering. I forced myself to do it, and I offered it. So what Samuel says to me, what's wrong with this picture, first of all? The first thing that's wrong with this picture is obviously the fact that Saul's not supposed to be offering the sacrifices. That's number one. Number two, he hasn't waited for Samuel. But the bigger problem here is that he hasn't trusted God. Because apparently he forgot about the history of Gideon. We talked about it this morning in Bible class. How many men did Gideon have with him? 300. How big was the Midianite army that he defeated? 135,000. Okay? If God can defeat 135,000 with 300, I think he can take on 30,000 with 3,000. The biggest problem here is that Saul is not trusting in God. And he's saying he needs to entreat for the favor of the Lord. But the other problem is his whole perspective on sacrifice is warped and twisted and bent out of shape because he doesn't understand what a sacrifice is for. What Saul is doing is he's treating this sacrifice as if it's a magical talisman, as if I can offer the sacrifice and that means the Lord will bless us and give us victory. And so the sacrifice is a magical spell that gives us victory. It doesn't work that way. It didn't back then, and it doesn't now. You're going to see where I'm going with this in just a second. Don't worry. It doesn't work that way. But Saul is thinking that way anyway. And at the end, after the people start leaving, he's got only 600. But guess what? God gives him victory anyway. Huh? Could have done it with less. But what Samuel says is, he says, this is verse 13 of chapter 13. Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God with which he commanded you. For then the Lord would have established your kingdom forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. And the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people. Because you have not kept what was commanded you. And Samuel arose and he went up from Gilgal. And the rest of the people went up after Saul to meet the army. And they go and they fight. Of course, we know that what this text is talking about is the selection of David. Because the next chapter is Jonathan achieving victory. And then we have another chapter that we're going to get into now. But chapter 16 is David is anointed by Samuel. And that's sort of Samuel's last great prophetic act. See, his last act was supposed to be anointing Saul. And then he was going to retire. But then Saul asked him to come out of retirement to bless the army, and so he does, and then problems ensue. And so his real last act is to appoint Saul's successor. And that's his last task as a prophet. But what happens just before that? Chapter 15, verse 1. Samuel said to Saul, the Lord has sent me to you to anoint you king over his people, Israel. Now, therefore, listen to the words of the Lord. This is your last chance, Saul. God made you king. You know what I've told you. God is giving you one last chance. This is what the Lord of hosts says. I have noted what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. This is a harsh punishment. We can talk about the ethics of it later. So Saul summoned the people and he numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 men on foot and 10,000 men of Judah. And Saul came to the city of Amalek and he lay in wait in the valley. And Saul said to the Kenites, go down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the people of Israel when they came up out of Egypt. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. And then Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt. And he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. And devoted to destruction all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag, and the best of the sheep, and of the oxen, and of the fatted calves, and the lambs, and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them. All that was despised and worthless they devoted to destruction. And the word of the Lord came to Samuel. I regret that I have made Saul king. For he has turned back from following me, and he has not performed my command. And then Samuel was angry, and he cried to the Lord all night. And then Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning, and it was told Samuel, Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up a monument for himself. And he turned and he passed on and he went down to Gilgal. And Samuel came to Saul and Saul said to him, blessed be you to the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. And I kind of love Samuel at this moment. Oh, really? You've done what God told you to do. Hold on. What is that I hear right now? Did I just hear something? Did I just hear sheep? Did I just hear some cows? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I heard sheep and cows. And this is the tone of what he says. I mean, what he says are how the words are ordered in Hebrew, but the tone is very sarcastic. I mean, this is the way we would phrase it in our language. I'm sorry, I could not have just heard sheep. No, that could not have happened because you did what God told you. You destroyed everything, right? I didn't just hear cows, because you said you performed the commandment of the Lord. So I didn't just hear sheep and cows. No, I didn't. Well, the people, they spared the best of it to sacrifice to the Lord your God. And they spared King Agag. The rest we have devoted to destruction. And Samuel's response to Saul, I mean, the word he uses, the way it's translated is stop. But what it really means is, Saul, shut up. Saul, just shut up. No. Don't give me that. I'm going to tell you something that I heard this night. I'm going to tell you what God told me. So Samuel said, though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord set you on a mission. And he said, go devote to destruction the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you pounce on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord? And Saul answered Samuel, but I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I have gone on the mission which the Lord has sent me. I have brought King Agag, king of Amalek, and I have devoted the Amalekites to destruction. Details, dude. You kind of missed a few. But the people took of the spoil, sheep and the oxen, the best of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal. And Samuel said, has the Lord as great delight in sacrifice and burnt offerings as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than to sacrifice, and to listen to than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is like iniquity and idolatry. And because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. And this is the nail in Saul's in the coffin of Saul's dynasty. So Saul says, well, I have sinned. Yeah, I know. I have sinned. I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Who's the king? You think Saul wasn't used to getting his way by now? We know that he's used to getting his way because of how he acts when he doesn't get his way when David is around. So we know he's used to getting his way. So we know the people did this because Saul ordered them to do this. Samuel says, I will not return with you. You have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. And Samuel leaves. He turns around. He starts walking away. And Saul grabs at him, and a piece of Samuel's robe tears off in Saul's hand. And then that's when Samuel says, yeah, like that robe, yeah, that's God taking Israel away from you and giving it to your neighbor who's better than you. And that's when he goes. He leaves from there directly to the house of Jesse to anoint David. And he says, God is done with you. He's not going to change his mind anymore. His mind is made up now. He has given you chance after chance after chance. Let's go back to chapter 13. Back in verse 13. Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, for then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. Take a minute to swallow that. That means the Messiah may very well have come from the line of Saul instead of the line of David. Saul had just obeyed God. And then I preached about David and Goliath recently, so I won't get into that, only to say that, let's remember, it was Saul's opportunity to be the defender of his people. And he cowered back in fear and let a teenager do it instead. And we could talk about how after David is anointed as king, he goes into the service of Saul, and Saul becomes jealous, and then he eventually drives David away by trying to kill him with a spear in the middle of the throne room. It's usually bad policy to try and murder the captain of your personal bodyguard in public. That tends to earn you disloyalty with the army. Just saying. That's not typically good. But I want to skip over the most of that. And we could also talk about how when Saul, David is on the run from Saul, Saul continues to pursue him over and over again to the point where David actually has Saul in his own hands and can kill him and would get away with it. Not only would he get away with it in the eyes of men, God may very well have actually considered it justified because Saul was trying to kill him and that was self-defense. It's entirely possible that God would have considered David killing Saul to be justified. We don't know because David didn't choose to do it. He chose the higher road. He chose to wait for Saul to die by someone else's hand than to take it upon himself to put himself on the throne. Sounds like David paid attention to Abraham and Sarah and Hagar. But so many other people did. But the last text I want to look at before we stop and analyze his life a little bit. It's 1 Samuel 28. the Philistines are going to war again. And they're marching against Israel again. And Samuel has died. And Israel has mourned him and buried him. And Saul had actually chased all the necromancers and practicers of with the sorcerers of his day, chased them all out of the land. And that's a good thing. All right? Good. Great. Good thing. I'll give him credit for that. But what does he do? Saul's in a bind again. And the terrifying thing for Saul is that he's not just facing the Philistines. He may very well be facing David. Because for the last several years, David has been in the employ of the king of Gath. The very city of Goliath. David is now a very lethal and powerful mercenary in Gath. David is now a name that is honored among the Philistines, not just Israel. So what happens when the men of Judah march in their army and they see that David is on the opposing side? Saul has every right to be afraid. Now, David sits this battle out. But Saul's afraid for a lot of different reasons. So where has Saul always gone for help? Samuel. He's always gone to Samuel to get help. Only Samuel's dead. So what he does is he finds a necromancer. He finds a sorcerer, a practicer of witchcraft. And he goes to this necromancer and he pays her to summon the spirit of Saul. And the spirit of Samuel. It's hard to summon the spirit who's standing right in front of you. But he pays her to summon the spirit of Samuel. Now, I'm not going to get into the theology of whether this happened on a regular basis and whether God allowed it or why he would have allowed it and whether this means that the plagues worked by Pharaoh's magicians actually happened or not or whether it was just sleight of hand. I'm not going to get into that. That's a discussion I'm happy to have with you after worship service or any other time. Please ask me that question. I would love to sit down and talk about it and study it with you. But here's the thing. For whatever reason, whether it was a one-time thing or whether God had allowed this a lot in the past, and at this time it was a regular thing for Satan to have this kind of power and dominion, God allows it. And the spirit of Samuel comes and speaks to Saul. And he ain't happy. I was happy with God resting. I was done with you. But here you go, dragging me back into your life after I'm at peace. Thank you very much, Saul. Guess what God has to say to you? Here's one last message from God. You're going to die. Neither you nor your son will survive this battle. And so Saul goes out to war. And in chapter 31, we find that he's trying to flee. And he gets wounded. And rather than allow the Philistines to kill him, when the man who took David's place guarding Saul's back in combat, when that man refuses to kill Saul, Saul kills himself. Jonathan also falls in combat. But Saul finally does the deed, and he does himself in. So, why did I want to look at Saul? Why did I call Saul remarkably unremarkable? Because a lot of these things in Saul's life, when we look at him, we look at them as if Saul is insane. Right? It certainly seems as if he's totally and completely insane. Doesn't it? Because Saul is remarkably unremarkable. What we are looking at in the life of Saul is the tragedy of humanity. We're looking at the ugly face of the human race. Going back to the very beginning of why did Israel ask for a king? They wanted to be like the pagans around them, right? That's the problem isn't that they wanted a king. That's not the problem. Deuteronomy 17, God's going to give you a king. Okay? But the problem is that you want God's king. It's that you want a worldly king. And so God picks a man whose heart at that very moment is actually worldly. And all throughout the narrative of Saul's life, God is constantly inspiring Saul to become better, and he's encouraging him. He sends him Samuel, one of the greatest prophets that has ever lived, to try and guide Saul into righteousness, to take him from the world and bring him close to God. But at every point, Saul turns away and says, "Nope, not going to do it." When he's crowned as king, he's hiding in fear. When he waits for Samuel, I mean, first of all, he treats the sacrifice as a magical talisman. Let's just stop and think about what human beings are like. And I don't necessarily mean human beings in the world. I mean people that call themselves by the name of Christ, too. Because Saul is remarkably unremarkable because he's just like every other human being that's ever lived. I mean, how many of us, and when I say us, I mean human beings in general, and even people who call themselves by the name of Christ, wherever they go to worship, whatever name is above the door, I don't really care right now. How many of us run away from the duties that are placed on us? How many of us try and get out of the unpleasant but challenging things that are placed in front of us on the table? Think about that for a moment. How many of us are afraid when we're supposed to wait for something to happen, but we don't like waiting for things, and we don't trust what's going to happen, and we don't trust other people, so we take it upon ourselves to do someone else's job, and we can never do it as well as they can because that's not our job, that's their job. And we end up making things worse. How many places call themselves a body of Christ but have unqualified men in an eldership? How many places call themselves by the name of Jesus but have someone who shouldn't be up in the pulpit presenting them the Word of God? How many of us are given chances by God to do the right thing but continually turn away from His will? And the fact is, this is just people. And if we're sitting here and we're examining ourselves and we're being honest, we've done these things. Each and every one of us, we've done these things. At one point or another in our lives, we have done these things. I mean, it gets to that point in 1 Samuel 15 where Saul is given his last chance to go destroy the Amalekites, his last chance that he has to serve God. But no, he doesn't. He goes and he does what he wants to do instead. I mean, this is people. Why do people do anything that they do? They do it because they want to do it. Now, we look at this and we think about this and we define Saul's behavior as insanity because it is. But it's an insanity that the entire human race shares. Because sin is ultimately the exaltation of self. I mean, I don't care what kind of sin it is. I don't care what sin it is. It's all about, I know better than God, ultimately. Ultimately, that's what we are deciding. How many of us have something that has happened in our lives? It seems like it, if we look at, back on it in hindsight, or how many of us know someone where something has happened to them, and it seems like it ought to be a wake-up call, but they don't change. I'm going to share a story with you guys, true story. You guys already know by now, I mean, most of you have met him at some point or another. My father's not a Christian. He used to be. He used to be where my mom had us worshiping at the time. He used to be the default backup preacher whenever Sewell was out of town at Embry Hills. He taught Bible class on a regular basis. And we always say that we like to have hope, right? There's always hope. I honestly have lost all hope. And I'm not, I mean, I kind of, yeah, have it, but I have zero expectation. Maybe something will happen one day, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I'd love to be proven wrong about this. Because I'd love for nothing better than to be reunited with my physical father and my heavenly father at the same time. But several years ago, I think it was I was in Indio, or was I at Loomis when Dad had his big thing? Loomis? It was around Thanksgiving. I think it was Loomis. I think I drove, yeah, I drove down. I remember driving on 5 at night through the Central Valley. That's fun. Try that sometime. All the trucks going 90 miles an hour. I was in Loomis. I was working with Don Wilson. A lot of you guys know him. But my dad had had a really bad sinus infection. And he went through 2 rounds of antibiotics, and the sinus infection still hadn't gone away. This is like, it is bad. And, I mean, I understand the doctors not wanting to prescribe him any more antibiotics after 2 full rounds, because that can really mess up your digestive tract, like really, really badly. But here he is, he's getting sick, and he's getting sick, and he's getting sick. And he's like, I'll be okay, I'll just get through it. And whatever, dude. Okay, all right. I mean, he's in the shower one day. And he slips and he falls on his hand and he breaks his wrist. And okay, that's a problem, right? All right. And he breaks his wrist because he's so lightheaded. And he's kind of talking gibberish. And so mom rushes him to the ER. And the clerk at the reception desk in the ER, they're having this little verbal warfare between them. At least his symptoms, she's thinking it's, you know, it's another person in the ER. Like, I understand, your job gets monotonous, right? My brother worked that job for a while. The number one complaint in the ER is lot of fever, LOTTAFEBER. But, you know, my dad's like talking total gibberish and, you know, the woman's trying to talk to my dad. That's not going to work. And so my mom finally, you know, forces it through her. And, you know, a nurse happens to come in. And they take my dad's blood pressure. My dad has really high blood pressure to the point that even when he's on medication to lower it, it's still on the high side of normal, sometimes above the high side of normal. And so he gets his blood pressure taken. And it's to the point where, like, dude, how are you not a corpse? It's that low. So they rush him into the ER, and they're trying to find out what's wrong with him, and they don't really understand because they're thinking one thing, they're thinking another thing, and they're thinking this other thing. And so a couple days happen, and I mean, they have a cast on his wrist by now, but his wrist is gigantic because it's so swollen because he's retaining water. And the reason he's retaining water is because his organs have shut down. And so, I mean, they tagged some of his white blood cells with a radioactive isotope, right? Dean probably knows exactly what I'm talking about. So they put him back inside, and they start trying to where they do a radiological scan, and they look at where is the radiation coming from, because that can tell you where